If I could get everybody to take their seats, please. Thank you very much. This hearing will come to order, and I want to welcome all of you to our first legislative hearing of this year. We do have a full plate on the agenda, and so I'm going to highlight each bill briefly for you before recognizing Ms. Berkley, if she is able to arrive in time, because unfortunately she's over in international relations as well. H.R. 23, the belated thank you to the Merchant Marine Mariners of World War II Act of 2005, would direct the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to pay a monthly tax-free benefit of $1,000 to certain honorably discharged veterans of the U.S. Merchant Marine or to their survivors. H.R. 601, the Native American Veterans Cemetery Act, would authorize the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to make grants to tribal organizations to assist them in establishing, expanding, or improving veteran cemeteries on trust lands. H.R. 2188 would authorize the placement of memorial markers in a Department of Veteran Affairs National Cemetery for the purpose of commemorating service members or other persons whose remains are interred in an American Battle Monuments Commission cemetery. H.R. 2963, the Dr. James Allen Disabled Veterans Equity Act, would allow certain veterans who receive disability compensation of at least 10% for impairment of vision in one eye to be eligible to receive such compensation for impairment of vision in the other eye that is deemed not related to their military service. H.R. 4843, the Veterans Compensation Cost of Living Adjustment Act of 2006, would increase effective December 1st of 2006 the rates of disability compensation and dependency and indemnity compensation. H.R. 5037, the Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act, would prohibit demonstrations within 500 feet of a national cemetery and Arlington National Cemetery during a funeral service. Violation of the prohibition would be punishable by up to a year imprisonment under Title 18 of the United States Code. And finally, last on the agenda would be H.R. 5038, the Veterans Memorial Markers Act of 2006, and this provides government markers for veterans who died between November 1st of 1990 and September 10th, 2001, and who are interred in a private cemetery. It would extend through December 31st of 2007 the current authorization for government markers for veterans interred in a marked grave at a private cemetery and would authorize the placement in a national cemetery of a memorial marker for dependent children who would be eligible for burial but whose remains are unavailable. Ms. Berkley is not with us at this time. I don't know if Mr. Udall, do you have a statement for the record?
No, Ms. Berkley's trying to make it, and we would just put her statement in the record, Chairman Miller.
Very good. I would like to recognize Congressman Moran for an opening statement.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here on all these issues. Particularly wanted to point out the legislation introduced by the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Rogers, and Chairman Boyer, the Respect for American Fallen Heroes Act. This is an issue that we have encountered in Kansas many times, and I'm interested in hearing the testimony and the story of your legislation. I also would like to point out, Mr. Chairman, that as a response to the protests that are occurring at funerals across the country, a group of military retirees and veterans have created, beginning in Mulvane, Kansas, the Patriot Guard. And these are motorcyclists, motorcycle riders who have traveled the country at the request of families of fallen soldiers to provide a shield or buffer between the protesters and the family and those who are attending the services. And I've introduced a resolution commending the Patriot Guard and would welcome Mr. Rogers and others' support of that resolution. We hope to have that legislation on the House floor in the near future. Again, just recognizing a group of Americans who have responded to what in many circumstances have become a very difficult circumstance. I have been to funerals in Kansas in which the protests have occurred, in which the Patriot Guard has been there, and it's a wonderful sight to see the hundreds, if not thousands, of motorcycles, flags flying, and see their response of revving their motors to drown out the sound of the protesters. really in tribute to soldiers and their families. So I commend you for your efforts in trying to correct a situation that we face in our states across the country, and I happily yield to the gentleman from Indiana.
I want to thank you for bringing up the Patriot Guard, the Riders. I also want to thank Mr. Miller and Mr. Rogers, Mr. Reyes. You know, someone could also interpret whether these, under the law, whether those riders could also be considered demonstrators. And so we wanted to make sure that the law was drafted in a manner whereby these individuals, of whom come to the defense of the family, could not be subject to penalty under the legislation. So I just wanted to point out they've been very thoughtful in the drafting of the legislation. I yield back to the gentleman.
Thank you. I appreciate you pointing that out. I was aware of that and pleased at that. And again, the Patriot Guard only arrive at the request of the families of these soldiers. And I'm honored to have with us today two of my constituents, Lauren and Lynette Stenzel from Ness City, Kansas, who are members of the Patriot Guard. And I recognize them and hundreds and really thousands of other Kansans and Americans who have responded to this circumstance. And I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moran. Your continued presence and work on this committee is greatly appreciated. I do want to recognize, for those in the audience that may not recognize him, the chairman of the full committee, who's going to be with us this afternoon, Chairman Steve Buyer. I take it from nodding your head a minute, you don't have an opening statement, but I think you will be participating in some of the questioning that will take place a little later on. And what we'll do is we'll give Ms. Berkley an opportunity when she gets here to have her statement either entered into the record or give her a chance to give it. Testifying first are the chief sponsors of many of the bills that we have on the agenda today. They're sitting at the front table. I'd like to take a minute and recognize everybody that's up there, and then we'll begin testimony. Mr. Rogers has led the bipartisan effort to restrict demonstrations at national cemeteries and introduced H.R. 5037 on March 29th. He represents the 8th Congressional District in Michigan. Mr. Shabbat of the 1st Congressional District in Ohio will be testifying on H.R. 5037. He's the chairman of the subcommittee on the Constitution at the Judiciary Committee. He and his staff have been invaluable to Mr. Rogers and the Veterans Committee in helping to draft this piece of legislation. We thank you. We also thank Mr. Sylvester Reyes, a member of the committee, represents the 16th Congressional District in Texas and is a chief sponsor of H.R. 5037. Mr. Filner, a member of this committee for 13 years, represents the 51st Congressional District in California, will be testifying on H.R. 23. Ms. Baldwin will be testifying on H.R. 2963, and she represents the 2nd Congressional District in the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Langeman, good to see you here, representing the 2nd Congressional District in Rhode Island, and will be testifying on his bill, H.R. 2188. And finally, Mr. Udall, who is also a member of this committee, representing the 3rd Congressional District in New Mexico, is a member of the full committee, and as I just said, the subcommittee in particular is going to be testifying on H.R. 601. Mr. Rogers, we'll begin with you, please, and Mr. Udall, if you don't mind, we'll wrap up this panel with your testimony. All of your full records will be printed in the record of the hearing, and each of us will hold our questions until each of you has testified. So, Mr. Rogers, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Chairman Miller. I appreciate this opportunity. And let me thank you and Chairman Buyer and your staffs for the endless time and questions and talent and energy that you've dedicated to get this bill and get this bill right. Mr. Shabbat has helped us certainly with and from his judiciary perspective. And Sylvester Reyes has been a real champion in this effort and been very, very helpful. Sylvester, who's been a friend in Congress, and we don't always agree, but we came together on this, and thank you for your effort. I think it has led this in this bipartisan way to get here today on something that I think is incredibly important, and that is really the dignity of the individuals who are grieving for their loved ones, for a fallen soldier, Marine, airman, or woman, or sailor, who has given their life in defense of the United States of America, and really what that means. And this bill, Mr. Chairman, protects the First Amendment, but it also protects the family. And really what this is America's chance to put our arms around these families and tell them we love them, we appreciate it, we certainly appreciate their sacrifice, and we will allow you the dignity and peace to lay to rest your loved one and have a celebration of their life and their sacrifice for their country. I happened to witness that personally in a town called Flushing, Michigan, a very small town, where Sergeant Joshua Yeomans was going to his final resting place. And to see the vile hatred, the taunting, the jeering of these families goes beyond the pale of any sense of decency I have ever seen. And when you look at what the family is going through to get to that part of their life, and certainly the grief and all of the emotions they're going to have to deal with, the one thing they should not have to deal with in this country are people trying to steal their ability for a peaceful service and ceremony. And they accomplished exactly that when they showed up that day. And here was, in contrast, this young 20s mother of a very young baby who Sergeant Joshua Yeomans got to hold one time in his arms when he died just a few days later, give the eulogy for her husband in a room packed with National Guard soldiers, friends and family, mourners, supporters, great Americans and patriots. The courage that she showed in the pulpit that day, talking about her soulmate, her loved one, her husband, the pride that she was going to instill in their young child, in what their father had done, in the service that he had given to his country. And to juxtapose that courage, Mr. Chairman, with what was happening outside, the jeers and the taunting and the songs that are not fit for public consumption, didn't take long to come to the conclusion that we have to do better by these families in America, and we can do better by these families in America. And I think this bill represents that. You know, just since we started this, just in my office alone, and I know other members here got emails in support, we have over 25,000 emails of support just since we started talking about this. That's just in my office, Mr. Chairman. That doesn't count all the other members. And the comments are very touching and very powerful and very strong in support of these families, of these military members who have given their lives, and what we need to do to give them their dignity back at these services. And for the record, I brought about, I don't know, there's about 5,000 here, I think, in paper form. We stopped printing them off and said, I don't think that the chairman might appreciate 25,000 individual sheets. So we've gone ahead and put it on a CD, sir, and without objection, I'd like to submit that to the committee on behalf of lots of Americans from Brighton, Michigan, to Iraq, to every state in the Union, celebrating what you're going to do here today.
And without objection, it is submitted to the committee, but not for the record.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Believe me, take some time and read just a few of these, and you will be moved to tears before it's over. And I just wanted to read a couple that we had pulled out, including one, sir, where I know you escorted the body back of this fine patriotic America, and it was his mother also wrote in support of this. And I'm just going to read these two, if I may, sir, for the record. And I quote, over the last 6 months, my unit has taken over 30 casualties in some of the most vicious areas south of Baghdad. The thought of their families having to face protesters after their memorials incites a rage I have never known before. These, quote, protesters mock all that we have accomplished here, the lives that have been forever changed and the lives that have been lost, using our most valued doctrines of faith and freedom as their defense. I cannot thank you enough for your dedication to this effort. I can only hope that the colleagues in Congress will join in this battle. End quote. Sergeant Ashley A. Voss, Baghdad, Iraq. Just a second one, if I may, Mr. Chairman. And I quote, thank you for creating and seeking the help of grieving families of our American heroes. My husband and I support this act 100%. Our son, Sergeant Trevor Bloomberg, was killed in action in Iraq on September 14th, 2003. We know the pain and horror in losing a heroic son, no less to have to face cruel, inhumane people who cannot dignify your time of grief. Please continue to place these families in America's hearts, America's minds. Nothing less is deserved. Mrs. Janet M. Bloomberg, a proud parent of an American hero. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we can say much more than that of those families who have given so much and really are pleading with us to please do something to allow them to have their dignity at this, it's probably the most trying moment of their lives. Let us show them that we appreciate this sacrifice, that we will stand with them, and we will proudly acknowledge their sacrifice for the defense of the United States of America. I will go ahead and submit a written statement, if I may, Mr. Chairman, and I would yield back the balance of my time.
Your statement will be entered into the record without objection. Mr. Shabbat.
Thank you much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be an original co-sponsor of H.R. 5037, the Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act, and to have helped author the bill along with Chairman Bowyer and Chairman Miller and Representative Rogers and many others that have been involved in this. As the Chairman of the House Subcommittee on the Constitution, my testimony today will focus on how the bill is fully consistent with the Constitution while fully protecting the respect and dignity of funerals held on and near national cemeteries. We are all painfully aware of the recent trend of demonstrations and protests occurring near military funerals on national cemeteries. Such demonstrations are not compatible with the respect due to our nation's fallen heroes, and they should not be permitted under our nation's laws. That's why I'm here today. The first provision of H.R. 5037 prohibits demonstrations on national cemetery grounds unless such demonstrations are approved by the cemetery director. This provision, in my opinion, is clearly constitutional under judicial precedents, most recently Griffin versus Secretary of Veterans Affairs. In that case, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals just a few years ago upheld as constitutional an existing federal regulation providing that, quote, any service, ceremony, or demonstration except as authorized by the head of the facility or designee is prohibited, unquote, on Veterans Affairs property. The first provision of H.R. 5037 simply codifies that principle in statute. The second provision, H.R. 5037, prohibits any demonstration within 500 feet of national cemeteries within 60 minutes before or after a memorial service is held there if the demonstration includes, quote, any individual willfully making or assisting in the making of any noise or diversion that disturbs or tends to disturb the peace or good order of the funeral or memorial service or ceremony, unquote. This exact language has been upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court in the case of Granted versus City of Rockford. The Supreme Court, upholding this language in the Granted case, specifically cited and relied on Webster's definition of diversion, which is, quote, the act or an instance of diverting as the mind or attention from some activity, unquote. Consequently, under this language, any demonstration that includes anyone whose conduct so much as tends to turn the heads of those participating in a funeral ceremony can be prohibited. At the same time, this language does not unconstitutionally draw distinctions regarding what demonstrations are allowed and are not allowed based on the content of the speech. The Supreme Court, again in the Granted case, upheld this precise language as constitutional because the language, quote, contains no broad invitation to subjective or discriminatory enforcement, unquote. Also, as the court stated in the Griffin case, quote, because the judgments necessary to ensure that cemeteries remain sacred to the honor and memory of those interred or memorialized there may codify objective description and may vary with individual circumstances, the discretion vested in VA administrators is reasonable in light of the characteristic nature and function of national cemeteries, unquote. Judicial precedents also make clear that H.R. 5037 is constitutional because it is a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. As the Supreme Court in the Granted case stated, quote, reasonable time, place, and manner regulations may be necessary to further significant governmental interests and are permitted, unquote. The 500-foot, 60 minutes before and after prohibition of any diversionary protest in H.R. 5037 is clearly a reasonable time, place, and manner regulation that furthers the significant governmental interest of protecting the sanctity of national cemeteries. The significance of this governmental interest is clear in existing federal law. Congress, by express statutory command, has long provided that national cemeteries shall be considered national shrines as a tribute to our gallant dead. Sections 2B of the bill defines the term demonstration to include picketing, speeches, the use of sound amplification equipment, the display of placards, placards, the distribution of leaflets, and similar conduct unless they are an official part of the funeral ceremony. This definition is sufficiently clear in my view and will not be struck down on the grounds that it is unconstitutionally vague. Indeed, the Supreme Court has upheld laws using terms like demonstration standing alone without any definition whatsoever. In conclusion, let me say that all supporters of H.R. 5037 are asking is that the families and friends of our nation's fallen heroes be given a few hours of peace within which to honor their loved ones' ultimate sacrifice. A few hours to pay respect to a selfless life devoted to protecting others. That is not unconstitutional. That is not even an imposition. That is the least we can do for those who have fought and given their life to uphold the Constitution. I urge all my colleagues to join me in supporting this bill, which will give the families of those who have died the comfort of knowing that they will be able to pray in peace and thank the fallen on and near the sacred ground where they will rest forever so that we can live free today. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shabbat. Mr. Reyes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on H.R. 5037, Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act. I have a statement for the record that if you would enter it.
Without objection.
And I'll try to just summarize some of the major points before I get into my comments. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you mentioned, I'm a proud member of this committee, have been since I've been in Congress. This is my 10th year. And I first heard about this issue, and I can remember the day because we were taking testimony when Chairman Buyer made mention of this on the issue of the IT system for the Veterans Administration. And I was hearing our chairman talk about this, I was sitting there incredulous that I was saying to myself, this can't be right. I mean, this information just doesn't register either as a parent, as a grandparent, or as an American. It can't be possible that there are those among us in this country that would use their First Amendment guarantees to prey on grieving families like this. But sure enough, we looked into it, it was everything that our chairman said was factual. In fact, the chairman, I think, went announced that day that he was going to a funeral and be there to help the parents of the soldier. Ironically enough, 6 days ago, Mr. Chairman, we in our community suffered our 22nd casualty. Sergeant Israel Devorah of Clint, Texas, in my district, was killed in Baghdad on April the 1st. This is what I think is most important in this legislation, and I appreciate my colleagues articulating what the legislation says. But the important points to remember for us is that when people are at their most vulnerable, and certainly those that have lost a loved one, I can remember when one of my brothers was killed by a hit-and-run driver many, many years ago, seeing my mom cry. My mom passed away 2 years ago, and up until her death, for some 35 years, she cried for my brother, Eduardo. So losing a son or a daughter is a tremendous blow to a parent. Having people exploit that for political purposes or for whatever purposes they may try to justify these actions is the most despicable, lowest form of preying that there is on the vulnerabilities and the misfortune of others. I can tell you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank my good friend and colleague, Mike Rogers, because he said sometimes we don't agree on the politics of everything here, but I can tell you that there hasn't been a single member of Congress that I have approached to co-sponsor this legislation that has turned me down. I think that speaks volumes about the outrage that we all share in this particular issue. So I'm proud to be here this afternoon to lend my support, and I'm proud to be the lead Democrat on this legislation because while it may there may be other pieces of legislation that affect more people that we pass here in Congress, this legislation speaks to those that have made in their own way their own ultimate sacrifice on behalf of our freedoms, and ironically enough guarantee that these misguided individuals can take those freedoms to an extreme that most of us find so despicable and distasteful. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to be here and share those comments, and I yield back my time.
Thank you for your service, Mr. Reyes. Mr. Chairman, do you have questions that you would like to pose?
Were you going to go with the entire panel?
I'd like to go between these individuals.
I would, but I would yield to all the members without objection.
I'd like to recognize you as the chairman.
All right. One question I have, it's unfortunate that Mr. Shabbat has left. It deals with the issue on proportionality with regard to the sentencing. And let me just turn to you, Mr. Rogers, because you've also been a former FBI agent. You've devoted a lot of your life to Title 18 and the enforcement of the federal code. So with regard to making this a Class A misdemeanor, you've looked at the issue on proportionality. If you could testify to that issue, please.
Sure. One of the reasons that we establish sentencing and the difference between Class A misdemeanors and felonies and other distinctions in the law when it comes to punishment for conviction is hopefully for deterrence. And you hope that the sentence at some point reaches the level of deterrence for that particular crime. Trafficking of liquor across the interstate lines illegally is a Class A misdemeanor, and fraudulent farm bonds is a Class A misdemeanor because it has a year in prison, up to a year in prison, which is a significant loss of freedom. And equally as important is the $100,000 fine that can go with it. That can be pretty devastating. And sometimes the financial part of it can be as devastating as the time in jail. And in this case, when we looked at what this means and what this crime ought to hold in relation to other crimes on the book, Class A misdemeanor, a year in jail and a $100,000 fine, we felt fit the needs and the proportionality to cause a deterrence for people violating the law.
And a Class B misdemeanor would be what?
It could be
6 months, 10,000.
6 months to 1,000. There are some 3 month conditions under Class B misdemeanors, and likely wouldn't. Quite frankly, in a federal system, would be very difficult to find a Class B misdemeanor where you would actually do jail time or get the maximum fine. So, this would at least leave the judge with, obviously, when you argue the severity of what this does to the family, to give that year in jail.
So these were individuals prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office into U.S. Magistrate's Court or referred to U.S. District Court if they choose.
That's correct.
On the other question I have is when Chairman Shabbat testified with regard to time, place, and manner restrictions to further a significant government interest. I'd like to ask the two league co-sponsors, in your belief, what would be the significant government interest?
Well, two things. Well, the first, I think the most obvious is how we treat the fallen soldiers who have defended the United States of America. Our government interest is to provide that buffer of peace, decency, dignity, and respect. They have the right to bury their loved ones in peace and dignity. And the interest in this is saying we believe that bubble ought to exist, and we do it other places in the law. We believe that bubble ought to exist for this very special is probably the wrong word, Mr. Chairman, but this unique event in someone's life that they have to go through this, God forbid, and bury a loved one who is a military fallen hero. We also protect that significant government interest in the First Amendment by laying down a framework of place, time, and manner. An hour before, if you want to circle the cemetery an hour before at a 500-foot distance and spew your hate and discontent, you can do that under the United States Constitution, and we preserve that right in this bill. But you cannot do it in a manner that does not allow these families that peace and that dignity, and I think that is a compelling government interest.
Mr. Reyes?
I also think that a compelling government interest in this speaks to the fact that there are the conduct of these people is so reprehensible that there are hundreds of thousands of Americans that are outraged, including veterans organizations. And they're looking for us to show some leadership and to show an effort to protect those families, because in the minds and eyes of our veterans community, it could be their families sitting there where circumstances different. So my colleague, Mr. Rogers, we have gotten hundreds and hundreds of emails and letters. I have been contacted in my district by not just veterans groups, but by individuals and non-veterans that are outraged at that this is going on, and that the possibility that they may have to take some action locally, as I just mentioned, our 22nd casualty on April 1st. And so they look to us to be able to take some action to provide that protection for the families.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Chairman Miller and Mr. Reyes and Mr. Shabbat, I think that you have narrowly tailored your legislation to further the significant government interest in setting the standards of decency with regard to our federal lands. Federal government owns those lands. And so you have not been, you're not overreaching with regard to veterans' state cemeteries, and I want to applaud your actions to encourage states to act and to set those standards. I yield back my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate your leadership and guidance at the full committee level. Mr. Udall, do you have any questions?
Just on this bill.
Mr. Moran?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bradley?
I would just thank the sponsors of the legislation, and in particular salute you for your bipartisan approach on this very important issue, and I look forward to being a co-sponsor of this bill, Mr. Rogers, this afternoon, please.
Sure. Appreciate it. Thank
you.
So it's on the record. It'll be done.
Ms. Brown-Waite.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a veterans cemetery in my area, and I think any one of us who have attended a service, either back at a veterans cemetery or here at Arlington, know the absolute need for it to be a moment for the family and a moment for every American to thank those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. I commend you for this bill, and I'm going to contact the members of the state legislature and ask them to implement the same kind of roles. They're still in session right now, and I think that it's a logical follow through, and I thank you for your leadership on this, and I've already said I would co-sponsor, so.
Thank you. And if I may respond as well, and one of the reasons that we called for the states to do this is because there has been so much work by so many, the council and the committee and others, the members, Mr. Shabbat and others, Mr. Reyes and Mr. Booyer and Mr. Miller, on the constitutionality of this to encourage the states to pass something that looks a lot like this will stand the test. And we've noticed some states have overreached a little bit. They are going to be taken to court, and our worry is that they will be struck down. If they follow what we've done here and take advantage of all of the effort that's been put into this bill, we will have a 50-state, all 50 states will have legislation that protects these families at the funeral homes, national cemeteries, at other cemeteries as well. And that's, I encourage you to do that, and thank you very much. And I think that's an important part of this bill we didn't get a chance to talk about today.
Thank you very much. We will move to the next bill by Mr. Filner, who is next up. You're recognized. And if I could also, while we're moving to Mr. Filner, make note that a member of our subcommittee is not with us today. Mr. Evans, as everybody knows, has made an announcement that he will be leaving Congress after the end of his term, and I would ask that each of our members keep him in our thoughts and our prayers as he goes through a very difficult time in his life. His service is to be commended not only to this nation, but to this Congress and this committee. Mr. Filner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for those words for Mr. Evans, and thank you for giving us opportunity to talk about our respective bills. Mine is H.R. 23, the belated thank you to the Merchant Marines of World War II Act. And, Mr. Chairman, you've had Democrats and Republicans here at the table. These are all bipartisan bills, and I appreciate the spirit in which you allowed us to participate with you. And I certainly, as a member of this committee, will pledge to you that we'll try to continue that spirit of bipartisanship that you have exemplified here today. So we thank you. The story of the World War II United States Merchant Marines is a story of patriotism, of youthful exuberance, of dedication to duty, of pride in a job well done, bravery in the midst of battle, and sadly of a nation who forgot these heroes for over 40 years after the war's end. World War II merchant mariners suffered the highest casualty rate of any of the branches of service while they delivered troops, tanks, foods, airplanes, fuel, and other needed supplies to every theater of the war. Troops were trained and supplies, ammunition, and equipment were manufactured in the U.S. and used overseas. And the merchant mariners were the necessary link between the two. Without them, we would not have been able to win the war. It's as simple as that. The merchant mariners took part in every invasion from Normandy to Okinawa, often becoming sitting ducks for enemy submarines, mines, bombers, and kamikaze pilots. Fighting was particularly fierce in the Atlantic, where German submarines and U-boats prowled the ocean, destroying merchant marine ships in an attempt to isolate Great Britain. Compared to the large numbers of men and women serving in World War II, the numbers of the merchant marines were small, but their chance of dying during service was extremely high. Estimates range up to 1,500 for the number of ships that enemy forces sank. 9,300 mariners lost their lives, 600 were POWs, 11,000 were injured. Yet an injustice was inflicted on this group of World War II veterans. All volunteers, once approximately 230,000 strong, the number of those currently living is estimated to be approximately 10,000. This group of brave men was denied their rights under the GI Bill of Rights that Congress passed in 1945. All those who served in the Army, Navy, Marine Corps, Air Force, or Coast Guard were recipients of benefits under the GI Bill. Only the United States Merchant Marine was not included. The Merchant Marine became the forgotten service. For four decades, no effort was made to recognize their contribution. The fact that these seamen had borne arms during wartime in the defense of their country seemed not to matter. After years of fighting the system in a court battle, some World War II mariners finally received a watered-down Bill of Rights in 1988. But some portions of that GI Bill have never been made available to veterans of the Merchant Marine. What did this mean in practical terms? First, and probably most important, it meant no GI Bill educational benefits. Instead of studying to become a lawyer, teacher, doctor, and a number of other lifelong professions that require a higher education, many merchant mariners had to rely on their high school education to get them a job. Lost opportunities, lost careers, lost wages were the results for the merchant mariners. No low-interest home loans were available to merchant marines, no lifetime compensation for related war injuries and disabilities, no use of VA hospitals, no priority for local, state, or federal jobs, no Social Security credit for wartime service. I know many of us, Mr. Chairman, have been able to achieve and become members of the middle class because of the GI Bill. I had my first home when my father got back from World War II, and it was a dream come true for a family that had lived with other members of their family for most of their lives. I would say there is overwhelming support now in the Congress for this bill. At last count this morning, a bipartisan list of 248 members of Congress had endorsed it. There is support from coast to coast. From the city of Los Angeles, California, to the city of New Bedford, Massachusetts, who have passed resolutions in support of H.R. 23. And Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska has introduced the companion bill in the Senate. A letter from Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta expressed gratitude for the service that these mariners gave during World War II. And I just received a letter this morning from a group of labor unions, the International Organization of Masters, Mates, and Pilots, the Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, the American Maritime Officers, and the Seafarers International Union of North America, which who have also endorsed this bill. And I would like to put that letter in the record, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection.
While it is impossible for us to make up for over 40 years of unpaid benefits, I propose that this bill will acknowledge the service of the veterans of the Merchant Marine and offer compensation for years and years of lost benefits. H.R. 23 will pay each eligible veteran a monthly benefit of $1,000, and that payment would go also to their surviving spouses. Their average age is now 82. Many have outlived their savings. A monthly benefit to compensate for the loss of nearly a lifetime of ineligibility for the GI Bill would be of comfort and would provide some measure of security for veterans of the Merchant Marines. In the words of General of the Army and former President Dwight D. Eisenhower, when final victory is ours, there is no organization that will share its credit more deservedly than the Merchant Marine. Franklin Roosevelt said, "The mariners have written one of its most brilliant chapters of the war. They have delivered the goods when and where needed in every theater of operations and across every ocean in the biggest, the most difficult, and most dangerous job ever undertaken." And Douglas MacArthur said about the liberation of the Philippines, "With us they have shared the heaviest enemy fire. On these islands, I have ordered them off their ships and into foxholes when their ships became untenable targets of attack. At our side, they have suffered in bloodshed and death. They have contributed tremendously to our success. I hold no branch in higher esteem than the Merchant Marine Service." So, Mr. Chairman, again, I thank you for allowing us to bring up this bill for a hearing today. I urge my colleagues, as everyone, I think, on the platform has co-sponsored the bill. And it's time, I think, to finally fix the injustices endured by our nation's Merchant Marine. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Moran, do you have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have no questions. I just commend the gentleman from California, Mr. Filner. He's been an advocate for veterans of all services, all branches, for a long time. And this is just one more of his many efforts in regard to making certain that no one is left out in the recognition for the service to our country. And I, too, am pleased to be a sponsor of this legislation. I thank Mr. Filner for his efforts.
Mr. Udall.
Thank you.
Mr. Bradley.
Ditto Mr. Moran's comments. Thank you, Mr. Filner.
Thank you, sir.
Ms. Brown-Waite.
Whenever I'm meeting with veterans throughout my district, inevitably this issue comes up, and we still, thankfully, do have a lot of veterans left who did serve in the Merchant Marine. Certainly it's time to recognize their service and their great contribution. And as you said, every member up here is on the bill, and I think it's time we move it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. I'd also like to ask Mr. Filner, with your acknowledgement, if we could have any veterans that were Merchant Marines that are here today, if you'd please stand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your service very much.
They're going to be testifying in a later panel.
Very good. Just asking for y'all to stand.
They're not ready to have you yet. Pardon? We're not ready to have your testimony yet.
Okay.
They just wanted to say hi.
They listen to you. We don't. Thank you very much, Mr. Filner. Ms. Baldwin, you're next testifying on 2963.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I really appreciate this opportunity to address the subcommittee on H.R. 2963, the Dr. James Allen Disabled Veterans Equity Act. It's a bill that I introduced along with my co-author, Congressman Bozeman, last year. This bill addresses an inequity in the paired organ statute that has resulted in the denial of appropriate disability compensation to blinded veterans. This committee and this Congress have rightly recognized that certain human organs or limbs are designed to work in pairs: hands, legs, kidneys, lungs, ears, and of course eyes. In the instance of eyes, blindness in one eye profoundly affects depth perception, even if sight is fully retained in the other eye. The paired organ statute was written to assist those veterans who experience a service-connected loss of a paired organ or limb. This statute recognizes the interdependency of paired organs and endeavors to treat the combined disability created by a non-service-connected loss, injury, or degeneration of the remaining paired organ or limb as though it were the result of a service-connected disability. In general, the paired organ statute accomplishes this task, with the exception of its treatment of loss of sight. I want to begin by telling you the story of Dr. James Allen, after whom this legislation is named. Dr. Allen is a professor of ophthalmology at the University of Wisconsin Medical School in my district, and he has worked at the Veterans Affairs Hospital for 33 years and treated numerous eye patients, including veterans who are blind. One such example is Mr. Donald May. Don is a World War II veteran who lost his right eye in a hand grenade explosion. A few years ago, Mr. May became legally blind in the non-service-connected left eye. He applied to the Department of Veterans Affairs for help and was denied further benefits. He was told that the current law in regard to paired organs did not apply to him, even though he was legally blind in his service-connected right eye. After Dr. Allen brought the plight of his patients to my attention, I began to research why these veterans were being denied the benefits that I felt they deserved, benefits that I believe Congress intended to grant them. Through my work with the Blinded Veterans Association, we discovered that while the current paired organ statute covers blindness, in practice, few, if any, veterans have been able to qualify for compensation under its provisions. In theory, the statute provides that when a veteran who is service-connected for blindness in one eye could qualify for additional disability compensation if they became blind in the remaining eye for non-service-connected reasons. However, the statute does not define the term blindness, nor is any provision made for impairment of vision in the non-connected eye short of blindness. Rather than using the visual acuity of 20 over 200 as the definition of legal blindness that has been adopted, by the way, in all 50 states and by the Social Security Administration and the World Health Organization, the Department of Veterans Affairs uses an obscure and much more restrictive 5 over 200 acuity for blindness, which is, in rough layman's terms, the equivalent of having an eye with light perception only, no ability to perceive shapes, etc. As a result, few, if any, blinded veterans are able to qualify for additional compensation under the paired organ statute. Consequently, I began to explore various options to address this inequity in current law. H.R. 2963 allows veterans who receive veterans disability compensation for impairment of vision in one eye at the rate of at least 10% to be eligible to receive additional disability compensation for impairment of vision in the eye that is not service-connected. This change in law would affect only a small percentage, estimated to be roughly 5% of the some 13,100 veterans who are service-connected for loss of vision in one eye. Yet such a change would send a powerful signal to our nation's blinded veterans that the hardships they face are not forgotten. Once again, I'd like to thank the chairman and ranking member and full subcommittee for the opportunity to appear on behalf of the Dr. James Allen Disabled Veterans Equity Act. It is certainly a modest but an important step in restoring fair treatment to those blinded due to their service to our country and to further our commitment to them. Their sacrifices and service to this nation should be matched by our desire to improve quality of life for them and for their families. And I look forward to working with you to advance this legislation. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Mr. Udall? Mr. Moran?
Nothing other than to indicate to Ms. Baldwin appreciation for her bringing this interest, this issue to my attention. Had not thought about this particular topic and appreciate being made aware. And thank you for coming before our subcommittee.
Bradley.
Echoing the words of Mr. Moran, thank you for your advocacy, and I'm pleased to be a co-sponsor.
And Mr. Baldwin, I understand that the subcommittee staff is currently working with you, looking at the numbers as it relates to expense of the bill, and I would expect that we will have an opportunity to re-enter dialogue after we hear back from CBO. So thank you for bringing this bill forward this afternoon. Mr. Langevin, with 2188.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. And before I begin, I would just like to take a moment to add my voice of support to particularly Mr. Filner's bill. Both my grandfather, John Barrett, and his brother, my great uncle, after whom I was named, Jim Barrett, both served in the Merchant Marines during World War II. They have both since long passed away, as well as their spouses. So my family, of course, there's no surviving member that would benefit financially from this, an effort for full disclosure, but it's the right thing to do to honor our Merchant Marines and the sacrifice that they gave during World War II. But Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Berkeley, who is also a sponsor of 2188, and distinguished members of this subcommittee, I want to thank you for having this important hearing today on all of these bills, and especially for the opportunity to discuss H.R. 2188, a bill that would authorize memorial markers in a national cemetery to commemorate service members buried in American Battle Monuments Commission Cemetery. As members of Congress, we all have the great opportunity to hear stories of duty and honor from our constituents. I had such a chance right after Memorial Day in 2004 when I received a letter from Henry Stad, a resident of Rhode Island and a U.S. Air Force veteran of World War II. Mr. Stad asked that I sponsor a bill that would allow family members of service members that were killed in action and buried overseas to be able to request a burial plaque to be set in a family burial plot in the United States. I was happy to look into this request from a man who gave so much for our country. Mr. Chairman, as you know, the United States currently has 24 permanent overseas burial grounds that are the final resting place for nearly 125,000 of the brave men and women who died serving our country. These sites are the responsibility of the American Battle Monuments Commission and are a wonderful tribute to those who sacrificed for our nation. However, the Department of Veterans Affairs maintains that because these graves can be visited, there's no need to provide families at home with a memorial marker for their deceased loved ones buried there. Now, as a result, I introduced a bill that will help families memorialize those who died in service to our country and are buried in cemeteries overseas. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, those service members whose remains are classified as unavailable for burial are eligible for government-provided memorial markers or headstones. While this classification includes those whose remains have not been recovered or who were buried at sea, there is one glaring exception to this definition: those who died fighting for freedom abroad and were laid to rest there. Now, families are proud of these courageous men and women who answered the call to protect our country and then paid the ultimate sacrifice. Unfortunately, for many families, a trip abroad to visit their loved one's final resting place is not possible due to finances or old age. A memorial marker is a way to keep the memory of their loved ones alive while also teaching younger generations about sacrifice. We should not deny the families of these courageous men and women the ability to obtain memorial markers when we already do it with so many others. To correct this, my legislation will add overseas burials to the VA's unavailable for burial classification and finally let these men and women be memorialized by their families here at home. Mr. Chairman, in closing, I urge you to help memorialize those that accepted the call to protect our country. Thank you again for this opportunity, and I look forward to working with you in serving our veterans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Udall, questions? Mr. Moran, Mr. Bradley? Thank you for your testimony and bringing this forward. And the last panelist is up here with us on the subcommittee. Mr. Udall, you're recognized to talk about your bill, 601.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I very much appreciate the testimony of my colleagues, Tammy Baldwin, Bob Filner, and James Langevin. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank you for considering my legislation today, H.R. 601, the Native American Veterans Cemetery Act of 2005, and would like to personally thank Chairman Miller for inviting me to testify today. Providing the men and women of the U.S. Armed Services with a final resting place is one of the missions of the Department of Veterans Affairs through the National Cemetery Administration. The NCA maintains 122 national cemeteries, including two in my home state of New Mexico, one in Santa Fe and one in Fort Baird. NCA also provides grants to states for the construction of state cemeteries with ongoing responsibility for the maintenance of the cemetery. However, one group lacks the opportunity to be buried close to home in a veteran's cemetery. Historically, Native Americans have the highest record of service in the armed forces per capita of any ethnic group, and New Mexico ranks fifth in the nation in Native American veterans with a population of 9,800 veterans. Yet, under existing law, tribal governments are ineligible to apply for a state cemetery grant. Thus, honorable soldiers are unable to receive the dignity of burial in a veteran's cemetery located on their homeland. My legislation would change that. Under H.R. 601, tribal governments would be put on the same footing as states, consistent with tribal sovereignty, by allowing them to apply for grants to establish, expand, or improve tribal veteran cemeteries. H.R. 601 enjoys broad support. A bipartisan group of 46 members of the House are co-sponsors, six of whom are members of the House Veterans Affairs Committee. I would specifically like to thank the ranking member of this subcommittee, Congresswoman Shelley Berkley, for her support, as well as Congressman Tom Cole of Oklahoma for his strong and early support. State legislatures in both Arizona and New Mexico have passed resolutions in favor of allowing tribal governments to apply for national veterans cemeteries. The Navajo Nation, the largest federally recognized tribe, is a strong supporter, as is the National American Indian Veterans Organization. Furthermore, both former Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Anthony Principi and current Secretary Jim Nicholson have expressed strong support, stating that H.R. 601 would create another means of accommodating the burial needs of Native American veterans who wish to be buried in tribal lands. I have included with my testimony several letters of support and would like to ask unanimous consent that these letters be made part of the record.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman and members of this subcommittee, this bill would give no special treatment and make no special arrangements for tribal governments. It would allow tribal governments the same opportunities as state governments and by extension would grant Native American veterans the opportunity to be laid to rest close to home. This bipartisan legislation is strongly and widely supported, I hope with your sincere consideration. At this time, I'd be happy to take any questions also.
Any questions? Mr. Moran?
No, sir.
Bradley? Thank you very much, Mr. Udall.
And I
understand how busy everybody's schedule is, and I appreciate the panelists being here to testify on their legislation that impacts the lives of our service members, veterans, and their survivors. And on behalf of the subcommittee, let me do say thank you again, and we look forward to working with all of you. Thank you. And with that, we will move to the second panel. If I could ask the second panel, which is VA and Arlington Cemetery, I believe, to come forward, please. Just a minute. I'd like to say thank you to the second panel that's with us today. Mr. Bill Turk is the Undersecretary for Memorial Affairs at the National Cemetery Administration. Good to see you, sir. He is accompanied by Jack McCoy, the Associate Deputy Undersecretary for Policy and Program Management at Veterans Benefit Administration. And rounding out this panel is Mr. Jack Metzler, the superintendent of Arlington National Cemetery. And I would say to any member of this subcommittee, if you have not availed yourself to a tour with Mr. Metzler of Arlington Cemetery, you should do so. I don't know of any person that is more knowledgeable about a cemetery and a national shrine as he is. I want to personally thank you for giving me the opportunity to learn so much more about Arlington National Cemetery. I understand your testimony last week was quite helpful to the subcommittee. I apologize I was not here, as I was out of Washington back in the district attending a funeral at Barrancas National Cemetery in my congressional district. So with that, Mr. Turk, you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bradley, Mr. Udall, friends on the staff, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today on a number of legislative items of great interest to veterans. As you noted, Mr. Chairman, I'm accompanied by Mr. Jack McCoy, Associate Deputy Undersecretary for Policy and Program Management, Veterans Benefits Administration. I'm also honored to share the panel with my friend of many years, Mr. Jack Metzler. With the committee's permission, Mr. Chairman, I will offer a summary statement this afternoon and request that my written testimony be submitted for the record.
Without objection.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'll proceed by discussing each of the bills listed on the hearing agenda in the order that they appear there. The first bill, H.R. 23, the proposed belated thank you to Merchant Mariners of World War II Act of 2005, would require the Department of Veterans Affairs to pay certain merchant mariners who served during World War II the sum of $1,000 per month. It would, in addition, require VA to make the same payment to the surviving spouses of eligible merchant mariners after these mariners' deaths. VA opposes enactment of this bill for several reasons. First, the Secretary of Defense has certified that merchant mariner ocean-going service during World War II was active military service for VA benefit purposes. Thus, World War II merchant mariners are already eligible for the range of benefits offered to all World War II veterans. This bill would provide concurrent eligibility for an additional VA benefit, a cash payment for merchant mariners not made available to other veterans. It would also provide for a payment to merchant mariners, even those who are not service connected, that is greater than the payment received by World War II contemporary veterans who suffered a disability, a service-connected disability of 60%. In our view, such preferential treatment to be afforded to merchant mariners would not be fair. Fairness would dictate equity, something that World War II already have achieved. Further, VA believes the Social Security Administration should be consulted on its views with respect to this legislation and the interagency coordination that it would require. H.R. 601, the proposed Native American Veterans Cemetery Act of 2005, would authorize the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to make grants to Native American tribal organizations to assist them in establishing, expanding, or improving veteran cemeteries on trust lands in the same manner such grants are made to states for these purposes. H.R. 601 would thus create another means of accommodating the burial needs of Native American veterans who wish to be buried on tribal lands. We strongly support enactment of this bill, as we have in years past. H.R. 2188 would make service members and others interred at an American Battle Monuments Commission cemetery eligible for placement of an additional memorial marker in a stateside cemetery. The Department of Veterans Affairs does not support enactment of this bill. The fallen warriors who are interred in ABMC cemeteries have been provided a place of repose and honor by the United States government. To provide a second marker for those whose remains are already interred in a federal cemetery would significantly alter the purpose of the memorial marker benefit. Memorial markers have traditionally, and we think appropriately, been issued solely to honor those who cannot be interred in a federal place of honor, either here or abroad, because their remains are not available for burial due to non-recovery from the battlefield, burial at sea, donation to science, or for other reasons. In short, we believe the honor of an in memory of headstone should be reserved for those who are not and who cannot be memorialized at a conventional gravesite. Those buried in ABMC facilities are already so memorialized. H.R. 2963, the proposed Dr. James Allen Disabled Veterans Equity Act, would improve compensation benefits for veterans in certain cases of impairment of vision involving both eyes. This legislation, which is consistent with prior congressional action pertaining to special consideration for hearing loss, would treat vision impairment in both eyes similarly to hearing loss in both ears. VA supports enactment of H.R. 2963, subject to offsetting savings. H.R. 4843, the proposed Veterans Compensation Cost of Living Adjustment Act of 2006, would authorize a COLA adjustment effective with payments received in January 2007 to the rates of disability compensation, dependency and indemnity compensation, and other VBA-administered cash benefit payments. We believe a COLA is necessary and appropriate to protect the benefits of affected veterans and their survivors from the eroding effects of inflation. We therefore support enactment of this legislation. H.R. 5037, the proposed Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act, would prohibit non-approved demonstrations at cemeteries under the control of VA's National Cemetery Administration and at Arlington National Cemetery. We fully support the policy objectives of this bill, though, as I state in my prepared statement, we are concerned that the text of this bill, as currently drafted, might narrow the ban, inadvertently, we think, already in effect on demonstrations in national cemeteries under VA regulations. I look forward to working with Congress to avoid this result, particularly if it is an unintended result, and to ensure that the dignity and sanctity of our national cemeteries is fully maintained. Final bill, H.R. 5038, the proposed Veterans Memorial Marker Act of 2006, would change the applicability date of VA's current authority to provide a government headstone or marker for the private grave of a veteran, regardless of whether the grave has already been marked at private expense. Under current law, this authority extends only to veterans whose deaths occurred on or after September 11, 2001. This provision of the bill would authorize VA to furnish such markers for the graves of veterans who died on or after November 1, 1990. We support enactment of this provision of the bill. In addition, this bill would extend VA's authority to furnish this second marker benefit through December 31, 2007. We support extension of this authority. Indeed, we would recommend that the legal authority for this benefit be made permanent. Additionally, with respect to H.R. 5038, we support a series of relatively minor statutory revisions, as outlined in my written statement, to accommodate the practical needs of veterans' families in obtaining government-furnished headstones and markers. We request that the committee consider adding these provisions to H.R. 5038 prior to or at its markup of this legislation. NCA's technical experts, of course, will be made available to the committee staff to explain in depth our proposed additions to this bill. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement. I appreciate the opportunity to have appeared before you to explain the administration's views on these important legislative matters, and I'd be pleased to entertain any questions you or the other members of the subcommittee may have. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The chair will now recognize Mr. Metzler.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before the subcommittee to present the Department of the Army's views on H.R. 5037 that would impact Arlington National Cemetery if enacted into law. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Secretary of the Army, who is responsible for the operation and maintenance of Arlington National Cemetery. Arlington is our nation's premier military cemetery, and it is an honor for me to represent this national cemetery, and on behalf of the Department of the Army, I want to express our appreciation for the support that Congress has provided over the years. In fiscal year 2005, there were over 6,500 funerals at Arlington National Cemetery. In addition, we conducted 3,200 ceremonies. H.R. 5037 would prohibit certain demonstrations at national cemeteries under the control of the National Cemetery Administration and at Arlington National Cemetery to include picketing, oration before assembled crowd, displaying of placards or distributing of certain forms or written materials on cemetery property. This bill would also prohibit demonstrations within 500 feet of a national cemetery 1 hour before and through 1 hour after a memorial, a funeral, or ceremony. The Army fully supports this concept of this proposed legislation as it pertains to Arlington Cemetery, because it would help protect the sanctity of the cemetery and the dignity of the funerals and ceremonies that are held upon its hallowed grounds. Demonstrations at Arlington National Cemetery have been part of the history of the cemetery since at least the Vietnam War. Because of our urban location within the heart of our nation's capital, Arlington frequently becomes a rallying point for groups wishing to express their opposing views and opinions, particularly regarding our nation's military policies. For this reason, certain conduct within the cemetery grounds is currently prohibited under Title 32 of the Federal Code of Regulations. This prohibition also occurs for memorial services and other ceremonies when our nation comes together at Arlington to remember the deeds and sacrifices of the brave men and women who served honorably on our armed forces. This newly proposed law would help strengthen the sanctity and preserve the dignity of Arlington. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I'd be more than pleased to respond to any of your questions.
Thank you both gentlemen. Let me start out by just saying that, Mr. Turk, because VA's testimony was not received until the end of the day yesterday, Chairman Miller and other members of the committee will be submitting questions for the record. So let me just ask a couple of quick questions. You expressed some concerns in your testimony about Resolution 5037, that it would be less restrictive than current VA regs that limit demonstrations on VA property. While VA regulations regulate within the grounds of a VA national cemetery, what effect do they have on demonstrations near but not on VA property?
Our regulations, Mr. Chairman, only extend to our national cemetery property. They do not extend out 500 yards or otherwise. When I speak, ours are broader. I'm not talking in terms of the scope of geographic coverage. I'm talking about the scope of activity that we have claimed the authority to regulate and which the courts have affirmed we in fact do have the authority to regulate.
Second question. When you exercise this authority to maintain decorum and not have demonstrations on the property, how do you go about informing people that may or may not know that these restrictions are in place?
Mr. Chairman, to be honest with you, I don't know other than, and I can certainly follow up with information on how we proactively get this information out. Otherwise, all I'm prepared to say now is if someone approaches us, and of course no one is going to come onto our property without approaching us for some sort of permission, at that point we would advise them of, one, our proper role in regulating conduct within the cemetery to maintain dignity and decorum, and then review with them the sort of activities that they have in mind and inform them at that point of our views with respect to those activities.
So if someone were to gain access, for instance, to Arlington and didn't appear that this was part of a protest and then unfurled banners and, you know, started a protest and they were unaware of the restrictions, what would how would you deal with that kind of a situation?
I will only speak for national cemeteries.
Yep.
I won't speak for Arlington. But if persons were to appear at our cemetery and start a demonstration without our permission, we would inform them, irrespective of the subject matter of their demonstration, that that was not permitted without permission,
mm-hmm.
and we would ask them to vacate the premises. If they did not vacate the premises, we would call the proper authorities to compel them to vacate the premises.
So if you gave them the opportunity to vacate the premises, then no further action would be taken?
I think that's accurate,
okay.
The way we operate
All
now.
Right.
Yes, sir.
So, good. Thank you.
I mean, I think that's a fair assessment.
Generally, that would be how you would handle it.
As a general proposition, yes.
Okay. Let me move to you, Mr. Metzler, and ask you the same questions about, informing the public, and if somebody legitimately didn't know that there were restrictions during a funeral from demonstrating, how would you handle that?
We would inform these individuals, either myself or one of my representatives would go up to them and ask them politely but firmly that they needed to stop during this funeral service. And at the same time, we would call the United States Park Police, who is our law enforcement authority for Arlington Cemetery. And if the individuals left quietly, that would end the matter. If not, we would invoke the Park Police to ensure that they left quietly.
So in other words, as you said, if people left and came back and demonstrated when it was appropriate to do so, then that would be the end of the issue.
Well, under the current Federal Code of Regulations, we don't allow picketing in the cemetery, protests, or demonstrations at all.
At all?
Okay. At all, at any time. I think the difference in this new proposed legislation, which is strengthening it, at least for Arlington Cemetery, is that there's a restriction now of 500 feet to the boundary of the cemetery, which is a tremendous benefit to us since we don't actually own the property.
Right. I mean, there's a bike path, there's a road, there's right. The bridge. I mean, all of those I actually like to myself run out there once in a while. It's a nice, beautiful run down the mall and up to the Iwo Jima Memorial and along that bike path. So under Mr. Rogers' proposed legislation, then you would, in fact, have authority to ensure that within that scope of area around the cemetery during those times that you would have the authority to regulate?
That's right. It would push them further away from the entrance to the cemetery. Oftentimes, they use the area right in front of the cemetery, again, which is not Arlington's property, to start a demonstration to march into Washington. This, again, would be ended under this new proposed legislation.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sure that the staff and members of the committee and the sponsors of the legislation, especially 5037, look forward to working with you to make sure that we technically get the language right to make sure that there are no unintended consequences and that the genuine thoughts of the Mr. Rogers and the other sponsors that testified to here today are what gets enacted into law, and we look forward to working with you. Mr. Udall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These questions are for Mr. Turk and if Mr. McCoy, if he's able to answer them. Your testimony objects to H.R. 23 because of the size of the benefit. Would VA support a lesser monetary benefit for the merchant mariners, such as the $200 per month provided to pensioners of the earlier wars who did not receive educational and housing benefits?
I think, Mr. Udall, the basis of our objections with this legislation is not necessarily the quantum of the payment being made, but rather the fact that a payment is being made to this class of veterans that isn't made available to other classes of veterans, and to these survivors that aren't made to other survivors. And I think it's that principle more than the $1,000 versus the $200 amount that you suggest here that's the basis of our objection. Beyond that, I'll defer to Mr. McCoy, who has more expertise on this matter since it's a VBA matter.
And I would agree with that statement and just add the fact that there are merchant mariners now that receive benefits, and then they would be getting an additional payment on top of whatever benefit they might be receiving now.
Could you please explain the VA's rationale for considering blindness for paired organs at a visual acuity of 5 to 200 rather than the level of 2200 used by the Social Security Administration and other government agencies to determine legal blindness?
No, sir. I can only explain it at this moment to the extent that is what our rating schedule calls for. I apologize, but I could not tell you, you know, to answer your question in more detail. I would be glad to get that to you.
That would be fine. Thank you. If you would submit that, that would be great. The administration's budget did not include a COLA applicable to the additional $250 per month paid to surviving DIC, dependency and indemnity compensation beneficiaries with children for the first 2 years of eligibility. Does VA believe that it is appropriate for the value of this benefit to erode with the passage of time?
I'll take that one, Jack. I'm not prepared to speak for the administration on that question. Since we didn't propose a COLA to that benefit, I think clearly I'm not free to state that we support it or we ought to have proposed it. I think, however, that the administration would not take the point of view that any benefit ought to be eroded over time that is currently received by veterans.
And could you take a position then, if you don't think there should be erosion, then we should somehow deal with it, shouldn't we?
Well, I can't take a position here and now, but I could certainly follow up with a position.
Good. Good.
On behalf not only of myself, but more significantly on behalf of the administration.
That would be just fine. Thank you. Mr. Metzler, does Arlington have space which would be unsuitable for burial grave sites, but might be suitable for placement of a marker of a veteran buried in an ABMC cemetery?
We have limited space at this time for memorial sections, as we refer to them. We're down to under about 300 spaces left in the cemetery. This proposed legislation, as I read it, didn't seem to affect Arlington Cemetery. It seemed to affect the Veterans Administration National Cemeteries. If it does eventually affect Arlington, it would concern me because the numbers are so great. Typically, in a year's time, we only receive about 20 to 30 requests for memorial markers, and they're mainly World War II veterans whose remains have not been recovered, and the families have just now found out about the benefit of putting a memorial marker up in lieu of not having their loved one recognized at all. If this legislation gets enacted and there's a potential of 125,000 new requests for not only Arlington, but for national cemeteries across the spectrum. This could have an impact on our availability of space for the other veterans in the future.
Mr. Tour, could you answer that for the VA National Cemeteries, that same question?
I think we're not in the position that Mr. Messler is with respect to Arlington. We have 122. Thank you, Jack. I had a minor lapse there. We have 122 cemeteries, some of which have no space available, some of which have several hundreds of acres available yet that have not been developed. So our position, unlike Arlington's, is at least less premised on the unavailability of space to provide this benefit than the rationale that we expressed in both our prepared statement and my oral statement.
In your testimony, you indicate that the number of requests for a headstone or marker for an already marked grave are nominal. Veterans buried in ABMC cemeteries were generally single and have been dead for over 50 years. In almost all cases, the parents of the deceased veteran would also be deceased. On what basis do you expect that requests for a marker or a headstone for a veteran buried in an ABMC cemetery would be more than nominal?
Well, I think there are next of kin, perhaps, of many of those interred or other family members. I don't think that we necessarily assume that all would request this. I think our statement is premised on the outlying potential cost that this would generate.
Thank you, all three of you. Thank you very much. And I don't have any further questions, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I'd like to close this panel and thank you very much for your testimony. And as I said, Mr. Miller and other members of the committee may well have questions for the record, and we will get them to you. And thank you again.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. I thank you.
Okay. Now we'll ask the third panel to be seated.
Is Mr. Filner a merchant mariner?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Congressman Filner, I assume you are here for purposes of an introduction? Absolutely.
I think all of us have had the experience, especially those of us who have the privilege of serving on the Veterans Committee, of meeting members of the greatest generation and since. And we just, the stories they tell, the courage that they exhibited, the patriotism they have is just an inspiration to all of us. And one of the people I've had the privilege of meeting is Ian Allison here, who is going to be testifying H.R. 23. He is the chairman of the Just Compensation Committee, which has been working on behalf of the merchant mariners. But he has a life that is filled with adventure, and I just love to be with him, so I just want to be here next to him today and share in his attempt to convince everybody of the virtue of H.R. 23.
Thank you very much, Mr. Filner. Let me just briefly introduce everybody. Mr. Ian Allison is the co-chair of the Just Compensation Committee of the U.S. Merchant Marine Combat Veteran. Mr. David Grenadier is the Deputy Legislative Director at AMVETS. Mr. Thomas Zampieri is the Director of Government Relations at the Blinded Veterans Association. Mr. Quentin Kinderman is the Deputy Director of the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Legislative Service. I'd like to just remind all of you, if you could do your utmost to keep your remarks to the five-minute limit. Your full statement, obviously, will be part of the permanent record and will be printed as a result of the hearing. Mr. Allison, please.
Chairman Bradley and other members of the subcommittee, esteemed members, I should say, my name is Ian Allison. I'm strongly encouraged the passage of H.R. 23. I represent 6,300 Merchant Marine veterans of World War II who are seeking their recognition and their benefits under the 1944 GI Bill of Rights. This group is a nonprofit, unincorporated committee of veterans registered with the Internal Revenue Service as a Just Compensation Committee. The committee has asked me to appear today before this subcommittee to represent their interests. The statements made here today have been supplied to me by various members of our committee for your enlightenment. I am requesting that the statements of Stanley Wilner, POW, Bruce Feltner, Perry Adams, and Burt Young be introduced into the records. These written statements have been delivered to the subcommittee. And I ask you again to be sure they're introduced into the record. Passage of H.R. 23 will be the final chapter of what has been a ragged response by the government to men who placed their lives in danger as they served their country. There might be some members in Congress who are not historically informed in what happened to some 230,000 seamen, both black and white, from the end of World War II to the present, and I can help present this issue. The Merchant Mariners of World War II were the only service that was not segregated. We had black and white both serving on the same ship. It has been said that when one dies, so dies one's influence and power. And so it was that when President Franklin Roosevelt died, his direction to his advisor that the merchant seamen of World War II should be accorded benefits like veterans of other services also who died. The influence of dissenting members and some of the animosities left over after the war from competing services and civilian service groups prevented benefits being given to the merchant seamen. Many service people who might have dug ditches in Louisiana and never stepped outside the United States got the full GI Bill, GI loans, and much more. But those who sailed the Murmansk Run were sunk in burning oil or frigid waters of the North Atlantic got nothing. In fact, their pay, which has been reviewed countless times, stopped the moment they went into the water. It was not until Senator Barry Goldwater in 1977 made the effort to recognize the women pilots with veterans recognition to the same bill, PL95-202, permit merchant seamen to apply for veterans recognition. Thus began the constant misinformation and countless examples of hatred for the merchant seamen effort to secure veterans recognition. There was growing lack of concern for Congress to do what was right, recognize the merchant marine veterans of World War II. The first stage of recognition efforts by the seamen came after a bitter court battle between the maritime trades and the Pentagon. A federal court judge in 1986 ruled against the Pentagon, stating that the merchant seamen had been discriminated against. He wrote in his finding that the Navy and certain veterans group bitterly opposed any recognition. While the court recognized the majority of merchant seamen as qualified, pardon me, these men only received a tombstone, a flag, and a discharge and limited medical attention. Those who went to sea after August 15, 1945 to December 31, 1946, the official end of the war, received nothing. They became the denied seamen. The Defense Department went to war against this group. This stated phase two of official congressional denial, it took 10 years of effort on the part of the Merchant Mariners Fairness Committee through five sessions of Congress until finally H.R. 1126 was represented Lane Evans as sponsor and 337 of his fellow members as co-sponsor to recognize a denied seaman with veterans discharge. A discharge that they had to pay $30 to buy and to pay for their own medals and received only a tombstone, a flag, and a piece of paper. Nothing else as a benefit. We are most fortunate many of the co-sponsors of H.R. 1126 are still members of the House of Representatives, members of Veterans Committees, and members of Subcommittee. They do not have the knowledge of how slanderous misinformation was continuously sent to House members by various military liaisons, stating that the merchant seamen were unqualified to be veterans as they went on strike during the war. A story by Walter Winchell about merchant seamen refusing to unload munitions and cargoes at Guadalcanal on a Sunday was repudiated, and the reporter was in disgrace. No ship has ever delayed in the war because of labor problems. It's so hard to counter lies, especially when many members had no direct knowledge of the history of the war. Today we call it bad-mouthing your opposition. Of the 230,000 men in Merchant Marine in 1945, probably less than 10,000 are still alive. The youngest who joined the service in 1945 are now 78 to 79 years old, many in poor health. Pardon me. The majority of the men in their mid-80s, as myself, I am 86, dedicated 100% of my time to see the record set straight by passage of H.R. 23. There's still a time for a grateful nation to say thank you for a thinning rank of men. We are now at a stage 3. 60 years is a long time before any service person to wait for proper recognition. 60 years is a long time to spend trying to correct history written to denigrate what we thought was service to our country. Getting closer. They say America is strong because of the will of the people and their concern for each other. Passage of H.R. 23 will go a long way in proving this to be so. Please recommend that H.R. 23 be passed, and let's clean up the record. These blemishes should not be part of our country's record. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir. Next, Mr. Grenadier.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, AMVETS is pleased to present our views on the legislation before the subcommittee, and we are honored to join our fellow veteran service organizations and veterans on the panel. Regarding H.R. 23, this bill would provide a $1,000 monthly payment to the Merchant Marines of World War II. If implemented, this legislation would cost $120 million for the first year and $20 million in subsequent years. AMVETS has no official position on the bill at this time, but I will say that we believe this bill will be extremely costly to VA. AMVETS certainly recognizes the sacrifices of the Merchant Marines during World War II, and we are proud of their accomplishments. But we would ask that you seriously take a look at how this bill would affect VA. H.R. 601 would allow Native American tribes to apply for state cemetery grants from VA. AMVETS believes cemeteries and tribal lands will be an appropriate memorial and a reminder of the sacrifices made by Native American men and women. H.R. 2188 would allow memorial markers to be placed in a national cemetery to commemorate service members whose remains are interred in an American Battle Monuments Commission cemetery. AMVETS shares the profound pride, admiration, and gratefulness associated with the spirit of this legislation. We support the bill, but we do ask that appropriate steps be taken to ensure that the lands used for these markers are not better intended for gravesites. H.R. 2963 would allow veterans who have a complete loss of sight in one eye due to a service-connected injury to receive increased disability compensation if they lose sight in the other eye. AMVETS recognizes the need and importance of this legislation. We support the bill. H.R. 4843 would provide a cost of living adjustment to veterans' benefits effective December 1, 2006. AMVETS supports our nation's commitment to care for the men and women who have served in our military service. This legislation will increase current rates of disability compensation to help meet rising costs. We support the bill. H.R. 5038 would allow veterans and their families to apply for and receive VA's official grave marker for an additional year. AMVETS trusts that the committee can locate the funds necessary to incorporate these veterans and family members with an official recognition. AMVETS supports the bill. H.R. 5037 would restrict protests at national cemeteries during military funeral honors. AMVETS wholeheartedly supports this legislation. We believe it is only appropriate that grieving families be allowed to bury their loved ones in peace. AMVETS is troubled and, quite frankly, offended that more than 100 military funerals in the last 9 months have been interrupted by aggressive war protests. Families burying their husbands, wives, sons, or daughters should not be subject to this kind of display. AMVETS believe this bill is very timely and hope it receives swift passage in the House floor. And, Mr. Chairman, AMVETS wrote a letter of endorsement for this bill, and I would ask that it be included in the record. In closing, Mr. Chairman, AMVETS looks forward to working with you and others in Congress to ensure the earned benefits of all Americans' veterans are strengthened and improved. This concludes my testimony. Thank you again for allowing us to present our views.
Dr. Zampieri.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, on behalf of Blinded Veterans Association, we appreciate the opportunity to testify here today on H.R. 2963. I'll try to make this very brief. I'd like to have the full testimony entered into the record. There's basically four points here of interest that we'd like to stress. One is that BVA would like to remind the committee that this isn't a new benefit or a new entitlement. We're just trying to fix the paired organ statute, which historically has been on the books since 1962. That's a real long time to have something on the books with an error in it of omission. And what we're concerned about, and we want to stress this, there's been, according to VHA records, 13,109 veterans who are service-connected as of today for the anatomical loss of an eye or blindness due to an injury or illness while they're in the service. And they searched the records to find out seven different ways if there was any other missing people out there. And this is the number that they kept coming up with. I go out to Walter Reed frequently to visit with every blinded soldier who's come back from Iraq since last June. And I've talked with the chief of ophthalmology out there. And to put a new face on this, there are currently 90 soldiers who've come back from Iraq who have anatomically lost an eye due to an IED explosion or due to a gunshot wound. Two of those soldiers are sitting out there today. And their concerned mother of one of those soldiers talked to me yesterday. And she said her son is doing well recovering from other injuries, but he lays awake at night worrying, what will happen to me if I lose my vision in my other eye? Under the current paired organ statute, which does not define legal blindness, if an individual who is service-connected for loss of vision in one eye puts in a claim for service connection under the paired organ statute, the VA refers to Section 1160, paragraph L, which defines legal blindness in a measurement form of 5200 in order to meet VA service connection compensation standards. Currently, legal blindness is defined in all 50 states by Social Security Administration, by the World Health Organization, is defined as 2200 or less, or 20 degrees of central field of vision or less. Basically, in researching this and actually working with CBO, and I'm going to cite their own figures, according to the Journal of American Medical Association Archives of Ophthalmology, and this is in the CBO report, the prevalence of age-related macular degeneration or other diseases that would cause an individual in the U.S. population between the ages of 40 and 65 to lose their vision is 1.4%. The figure rises to just 5% of the population between the ages of 65 to 80 years of age, and then doesn't increase until after age 80 to about 15% of the population. Therefore, if this paired organ statute is fixed concerning the 13,109 veterans who have lost vision in one eye, you could expect probably 600 claims. I talked to a VBA claims reviewer who had 19 years of experience, and he knows of five cases in the last 6 years. So we're not opening up the floodgates as long as we look at this from the standpoint of those individuals who served and lost an eye in service of their country. I'll leave it on this note that why should a veteran who served in the military and lost an eye and almost probably lost his life in service to his country have to meet a higher standard of blindness than a Social Security recipient? Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity for Blinded Veterans Association to testify today, and we're completely in support of H.R. 5037. Thank you.
Mr. Kinderman.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. And Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, thank you for inviting us to testify here today. On behalf of the 2.4 million men and women of the Veterans of Foreign Wars of the United States, We appreciate the opportunity to present our views on legislation included in today's hearing. Our views follow. Regarding H.R. 23, belated thank you to the Merchant Mariners of World War II Act of 2005. The bill seeks to expand the current dates of service for World War II merchant mariners who are recognized as veterans and pay a $1,000 monthly benefit to those World War II merchant mariners or to their surviving spouses. VFW recognizes the heroic service of merchant mariners during World War II. Their sacrifices and heroic efforts were instrumental in winning the Second World War. We cannot, however, support this legislation to pay a monthly benefit, which would be in addition to any current veterans' benefits that would otherwise be payable. We believe this payment would be disproportionate in terms of recognition and benefits to what other veterans who've gone in harm's way in service to our country currently receive. With regard to their service as merchant mariners and the proposal that they should be recognized for this merchant marine service by a special benefit in addition to being recognized as veterans, or for a period extending beyond the currently recognized World War II dates, the VFW has not taken a position on this matter. H.R. 601, titled Native Americans Veterans Cemetery Act of 2005, would allow tribal organizations to apply for grants to establish and maintain veteran cemeteries on tribal lands. We fully support H.R. 601. We believe this is a logical extension of the Veteran Cemetery Grant Program. This legislation will address the needs of Native American veterans and their families, which are not fully met by the national and state veteran cemeteries. H.R. 2188, titled Authorization of Memorial Markers for Remains Interred in American Battle Monuments, proposes allowing memorial markers to be placed in national cemeteries for remains interred in cemeteries administered by the American Battle Monuments Commission. The bill provides recognition on American hallowed ground to the many service members who made the ultimate sacrifice to preserve our freedom and never returned home. We fully support this bill. And I might say, as probably anyone would who has been to Normandy Beach and seen the memorial cemeteries there, that these are sacrifices that I think should remain in the consciousness of the American people. And I think making these markers convenient here so people can see the sacrifices that were made by the greatest generation is a good thing. H.R. 2963 is titled the James Allen Disabled Veterans Equity Act. The bill addresses the payment of service-connected compensation for service-connected loss of vision in one eye in the event vision is impaired in the other eye. And I doubt I could explain that anywhere near as well as Tom just has. We fully support this legislation. H.R. 4843, titled Veterans Compensation Cost of Living Adjustments Act of 2006, seeks to adjust compensation rates to reflect the rising cost of living. We appreciate the committee's commitment to maintaining the integrity of the buying power of the Veterans Compensation Program by providing periodic cost of living increases, COLAs. We fully support this goal. However, we note that this bill once again contains a provision for rounding down any fraction of a dollar in the COLA calculation. This works against the spirit of the bill. Over time and when combined with other adjustments made to meet budgetary goals, this has caused erosion of the rates of compensation and significant problems for America's veterans. We believe it might be the underlying cause of some policy problems that have been recognized by the committee. H.R. 5037 is entitled Respect for America's Fallen Heroes Act. This legislation restricts demonstrations at or near national cemeteries during funerals and requires approval by cemetery authorities for other demonstrations. The intent is to prevent hateful and offensive speech during a very difficult time for a veteran or service member's family. We strongly support this legislation, including provisions that urge state and local governments to enact legislation to protect funeral homes, religious services, and memorial services from this dangerous and damaging abuse of free speech. And finally, H.R. 5038, entitled Providing Government Markers for Dependent Children, we fully support this bill as well. Thank you for the opportunity to present the views of Veterans of Foreign Wars.
Thank you all to the panel. Ms. Berkley, you indicated you had a markup that you had to go back to, so I'll yield first to you for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I had a hearing at the International Relations Committee, which precluded me from coming and listening to the entire hearing, but I'm awfully glad I came for this panel and was able to get away. I want to thank all of you for your eloquent remarks. I am supportive of all of the pieces of legislation that have been discussed today and a co-sponsor of most of them, but I particularly want to thank all of you for your continued service to our country. Not only did you serve in our nation's wars, but you continue to serve the veterans of this country by your work through your VSOs, and this Congresswoman wants to tell you how much I appreciate that. And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to submit my written testimony written opening remarks for the record, since I'm sure that everybody has sat through a lot of testimony, and I don't want to burden anyone further. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Mr. Udall?
I don't have any questions, but I also just want to tell the panel, I think you've given excellent testimony here today and very much appreciate it. Thank you.
In that case, I have a couple of quick questions. Mr. Filner, since you're still here, can I impose on you to ask you a question? Thank you. As you know, I'm a co-sponsor of H.R. 23. Numerous other, and I would say that by virtue of the fact that I agree with you and that the what you're trying to accomplish with regard to the Merchant Marine, I believe is appropriate. But you heard the testimony from some of the other witnesses today, and other groups have had veteran status conferred on them in accordance with Public Law 95-202. Could you just testify as to why you think it's appropriate to single out Merchant Marines for this special monthly benefit and respond perhaps to some of the critiques that other panelists have talked?
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to defer to Mr. Allison on some of the more emotional kinds of arguments. Let me just say, by the way, that I heard about the amount of money. We're talking about $120 million that goes down to unfortunately zero in a relatively short time. $120 million is 0.2% of the VA budget, of existing VA budget, not 2%, 0.2%. There's a lot of myths about who deserves what at what time. Remember that this is a benefit for just the remaining years of life, not for a lifetime. And that, as Ian was telling me, the few that do get benefits were denied, for example, for disability, were denied all the GI benefit, the GI Bill benefits. So you have a lifetime that we're just saying here, a nominal sum is just a belated thank you. So you can never make up for that loss of benefits. And it's just, I think we can't afford not to do this. It's a moral, I think, imperative of our nation to recognize this. And most of them thought that they were fighting for the nation as part of our armed forces in World War II. I'd like Ian to comment on your initial issue about why this group.
Can you repeat that question? I'm a little hard of hearing.
Thank you, sir. I indicated to Congressman Filner that while I agree with him about the appropriateness of this bill and singling out members of the Merchant Marine for this special benefit, there are those that don't agree with that policy change. And so the gentleman, Mr. Kinderman, from the VFW testified in essence to that before. So I was trying to give yourself and Congressman Filner a chance to respond to that, why you think it's appropriate for singling out members of the Merchant Marine for this stipend at this point in time.
I appreciate that question, and I like that expression, singling out. I think that was the problem back in 1944. We were singled out, and we were dropped from the benefits that everybody else got. There's 14 million veterans. We're allowed the GI Bill of Rights in 1944, and we were singled out. We did not get those benefits. We didn't. There's dozens of things in the testimony that were given by my fellow veterans of why, what they experiences they had trying to get into college, trying to get jobs, trying to get make a living after the war when they weren't veterans. And it was quite flagrant to these people. It's dollars and cents. We were denied the college education. I only went to the 12th grade in school. I hustled and I did pretty good after, but that right of a college education was worth a lot of money, and the DOT and some of the Department of Labor, I think, said it's worth anywhere from $150,000 to $300,000 in 1945 dollars or $44. In today's, it would be $1 million that we were denied. And I think most people are denied $1 million would like to try to get some of it back, especially when they get 80, 85 years old.
Well, just for the record, I want to make sure you know I agree with you, and I was just giving you a chance to respond to that.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Kinderman, do you? I'm going to give you a chance to respond also.
Thank you, Mr. Bradley. It's very difficult to sit here and oppose a popular bill, especially when, in fact, I am a merchant mariner. I hold a merchant mariner's license, obviously not World War II. I think Mr. Filner said it. He said, who deserves what and at what time? This is, as you pointed out, not a unique group. There are other groups who, for various reasons, have not received veterans benefits at the time when they needed them, either through the controversy or the amount of time it took to make the deliberation on eligibility. The World War II merchant mariners took a long time. If you talk to Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange who suffered from cancer, they'll tell you it took a long time to get justice too. And there seems to be a tradition of when you make the decision, you move forward, you don't look back. So we would have concerns that if we move forward and we do this monthly benefit without any constraints or eligibility other than you were there, you served, and you're alive today, or your spouse is alive, it would certainly open up the possibilities that you would deal with many, many more groups. I'm old enough to remember when I first came into this business that World War I veterans, it would always have a bill, H.R. 1918, for a service pension. And there was always great support for that, but it never came about. So I know this is a very difficult situation for you.
Thank you very much. I have no further questions. If Mr. Udall and Ms. Berkley have no further questions, I'd like to thank the panel and thank all three of the panels this afternoon and state that without objection, statements by the following individuals and organizations will be entered into the record. David Fort, Cleveland Marshall College of Law at Cleveland State University. Lino Graglia, University of Texas Law School. John Fee, Brigham Young University. The Disabled American Veterans, the American Legion, the Paralyzed Veterans of America, and the Vietnam Veterans of America. I appreciate everyone's attendance this afternoon. This committee has a long tradition of bipartisanship, which I think you've seen on display here this afternoon. I think on behalf of the other members and Mr. Miller, we all look forward to working with you to ensure a productive year. And once again, we thank you for your participation this afternoon. With that, and with nothing further before this committee, I will adjourn the hearing, and thank you.